Kia ora, and welcome to Family, Whānau and Disability, a podcast brought to you by Parent to Parent New Zealand. We are here for the many Kiwi families out there caring for a disabled child or family member. We know the journey caring for a disabled or a neurodiverse child is not an easy or a straightforward one. So this podcast is a place to explore the issues that affect us, to share stories, swap tips, and even have a laugh or two. We would love for you to join us each month, so make sure you subscribe. Please also be aware that the views shared are those of the individual and may not represent the views of parent to parent.
Welcome to Connect, Inform, Support on Free FM 89.0. Brought to you by Parent to Parent, the not-for-profit organisation supporting families and whānau of babies, children, teens and adults with any type of disability or health impairment. We're going to be talking to Rachel Wilshire today because Rachel found out she was an Aspie when she was 12. It's lovely to have you along, Rachel, today.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking to you today about the journey you've had, which is quite an amazing journey. Now, I know you found out that you had Asperger's when you were 12. What led you to that, to get that diagnosis?
Well, at that time, so at the school I was at, Year 7 was when you transitioned from being in the kind of primary school part of the school where you were with one teacher for the full day to the more secondary school part of the school. So Year 7 was where you started having a form class and then you went around to different teachers for each of the different subjects. And I found that transition really difficult. So I would essentially have meltdowns every morning before going to school. I didn't really eat anything until I got home from school because I felt so sick about going to school. So it was a really tough year for my whole family, and we always knew that I had struggled with change and that I had issues with anxiety and things, but I think that was really just the point when my parents realized that they actually needed a label to be able to get the support that we needed. So we'd spent quite a lot of that year seeing various psychologists and psychiatrists, but eventually we went to Dr. Marshall in Wellington, and he was the person who gave me the diagnosis.
So what happened after that?
Well, so I guess it just meant that the school was a bit more willing to make a couple of adaptations to me, because sometimes just having that label opens the doors. But also for me, it was a relief. Like, I'm pretty sure the first thing that I said when he said, I think you probably have Asperger's syndrome, is, oh, that's fantastic, we have to tell everyone because then they can't bully me anymore. And Mum was like, maybe don't do that. That might not be the greatest idea. But it was good just to know that there was a reason for why I felt the way I felt, and it was good to know that there were other people who were the same as me and that there were books that I could read about myself. Because I used to, when I was little, I used to have this weird obsession with parenting books. Like, I would read all my mum's parenting books in secret. And I think in a way I was probably trying to figure out what exactly was different about me or what was quote-unquote wrong with me. And so knowing that there was then a whole, you know, there's a whole bunch of new books that I could read which would be all about me was a really great feeling as well.
Now, you graduated Ducks of Samuel Marsden College in 2012 and then went on to university, and I believe even year 13 there you had 8 subjects.
Yes. So that was one of the unusual accommodations that my school actually made for me. So I was really lucky that Marsden was very, very willing to be flexible for me, particularly in my senior years in high school. And the thing was that I've always been a person that's had lots and lots of different interests, and I just couldn't bear the thought of giving up any of my subjects. So in year 11, 12 and 13, I was able to have a slightly flexible timetable where essentially in year 11, because English is compulsory, I did that via correspondence because I found English really hard to do in a class environment anyway. And then I did 7 other subjects during the day. And then the other 2 years, I didn't have to do English, but I was able to do 7 subjects during the school day. And then in year 13, maths gets split into stats and calculus, but my school did a course where you did stats and calculus combined, so it was kind of 2 for the price of 1. So essentially it was about my school being willing to be a bit flexible for me and to say, so rather than essentially the time I was doing my extra subject was when other people would have been having their study periods and also doing things like PE and health and RE. So it was about saying, actually, Rachel probably doesn't need study periods, and she probably doesn't really need to be spending that time doing PE and health. She finds those subjects quite hard anyway. What will be better for her will be actually doing these extra subjects. And it was really, really, I think that was one of the things that actually enabled me to be successful at school, because up until year 10, I found starting school each year really hard. But I think because the school was willing to be a bit flexible for me, I had more of an incentive to make it work myself. But also, I'm the sort of person that I just have to keep really busy and I have to be really interested by things, because otherwise I can get quite anxious. And so by being really busy all the time with those eight subjects, that actually probably allowed me to achieve more than I would have than if I'd just done the standard five or six subjects.
After school, you went on to uni. How was that?
Mm-hmm. I found university really challenging. So I went to university in Auckland because I had a scholarship, and possibly I just wasn't ready for moving away from home and also, you know, moving to a new city and starting university. So I kind of, because I'd been quite successful at school and everything, and I'd gone overseas on science trips at school and things, so I was kind of, probably by the time I was in year 13, I was kind of like, you know what, maybe like kind of outgrowing the Asperger's diagnosis. Maybe that is not so much of a thing for me anymore, but it very much definitely is. So I just found the transition to university really, really hard. Yeah, essentially by the end of the first year, I wasn't really sure if I was going to go back. And I did end up going back because I kind of wanted to keep my scholarship. But again, by the end of the third year, it was just, I had a lot of depression and anxiety. I think partly because of the transition, but also, again, I just didn't actually find it that challenging. And so I got quite bored. And then if I'm bored, I get anxious. So, yeah.
So you came away from university with history and earth sciences. Tell me about earth sciences.
Well, so earth sciences is kind of a combination of geography and geology, particularly physical geography. So I've always been really interested in kind of the natural world. When I was little, I used to be really interested in New Zealand disasters. I could recite how many people died and all sorts of different New Zealand disasters. But as I've got older, I've become more interested in climate. And so a lot of the papers I did in earth sciences were climate related. Yeah, so that's kind of what that was focusing on.
Well, from history and earth sciences to dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is quite a leap there from earth sciences to dancing. But you started to teach dancing.
Yes. So, I mean, I've danced all my life.
Oh.
I took my first ballet class when I was four. And so I guess, well, it's weird because I always thought I would have dancing in my life. I always actually wanted to be a dance teacher, but I guess I didn't really see that as a valid career choice for someone who'd been, like, been ducks of their school. So I went away to do the university thing, but I actually decided to switch to studying dance because, for me, another of the ways that I control my anxiety is just by, you know, being physically active. And dancing's brilliant because you have to be really present in the moment. You can't be doing a dance class and thinking about what you're going to make for dinner or whatever. So it's really good for me from that perspective, probably more so than things like science. Like, science can be quite competitive, and it also can be quite isolating. And I think neither of those things were actually very good for me when I was looking at a career in that area. And I also just think that dancing's always been a really big part of my life. It's been a way I've been able to make friends, and it's been a way I've been able to control my anxiety. And so that's something that I would like to share with other people.
So tell us about Star Jam.
Yes. Mm. So Star Jam's a charity that does dance and music workshops for children and young people with disabilities. And they've got branches all throughout the country. So I found out about Star Jam several years ago now, but it wasn't until 2016 that I was actually able to start volunteering with them. So I've been volunteering with them for 2 years now with a workshop out in Lower Hutt. And then just this year I've started actually leading that workshop, so being the tutor, which just means that I make up all the dances and stuff. And that's definitely one of the highlights of my week. It's really cool getting to know all the jammers, which is what we call the young people, and just seeing their progress over the 2 years that I've known them.
You like to share with people in education too, sharing, talking about autism with students. You presented at the All Together Autism Conference, didn't you? Can you Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I presented in 2015 and 2017. In 2015, I was talking about the transition to university because that had been something that had been a really big challenge for me. And so I wanted to share some of the things that had worked and had not worked for me. And then in 2017, the theme of the conference was transitions, and I was like, wow, that's made for me, because one of the most important, or one of the most kind of aspy features of myself, is finding change difficult. And so I thought that was something that I could share a lot about in terms of just my own experiences and strategies. I think I've always been the sort of person who likes problem solving, and definitely I've been able to find things that really work for me. And so it's just nice to be able to share those with other people and just make people aware of, you know, what your options actually are, because sometimes you're just not aware of what things you can actually ask for.
It seems to be still more common for men and boys to get the diagnosis of autism. So what would your advice be for parents of girls on the spectrum?
Yeah, well, there's one of my favourite authors on autism is a woman named Jennifer Cook O'Toole, who's an American writer. She's an Aspie and her whole family are Aspies. And she's written a thing about how essentially one of the challenges is that the diagnostic criteria for autism and for Asperger's syndrome are based on boys. Like, most of the research has been done in boys. I think Hans Asperger possibly didn't even really think it was possible for girls to have Asperger's syndrome, or if they did, he thought it was a kind of milder version. He thought it was kind of exclusively boys. And so that makes it challenging because it presents quite differently in girls, because, you know, boys and girls have biological differences and also they're socialized differently. And so I think one of the things that people often talk about is that neurotypical boys are more likely to bully a boy with Asperger's syndrome who sticks out as being different, whereas neurotypical girls will often mother the girl with Asperger's syndrome. And I've definitely experienced that in my life, where the girls around me will, like, kind of direct me and nudge me in the direction that I need to go. And also I think sometimes girls are just better at mimicking or at pretending to be normal, which is what Leanne Holiday Wiley calls it in her book. She's another woman with Asperger's syndrome. And I think definitely my school always was like, she's fine when she's at school. Like, what is the problem? And mum and dad were like, well, she's expending so much energy fitting in at school that she just loses it when she gets home, because that's a safe space and she doesn't have any more energy left. So I think it's a thing. It's basically to do with the diagnostic criteria and then maybe some of just the differences in the ways that girls present. But the thing is that if you read books by women or girls with Asperger's syndrome, like, I immediately recognize myself. And it's amazing because, as I was saying earlier, you know, when I was little, like, when I found out I had Asperger's syndrome, I was like, wow, there's books about me now. And then it was kind of disappointing because I went to read them, but they were all by boys, and so I could kind of relate, but also it still wasn't entirely relatable. But whenever I read a book by a woman with autism, I'm like, that is exactly me. That is so spot on. Even just things like the typical special interests. So, you know, the kind of stereotype of a person with autism is someone who's interested in computers or train timetables. I'm not interested in either of those things. But girls are typically interested in things like animals or history or, you know, fantasy or literature, all of things that I've had really, really deep interests in. So I think if you're a parent of a girl with autism or who you suspect of being on the spectrum, the first thing to do is to just read things by other women and girls with autism, or get things for your daughter to read, because that's probably the best way of seeing whether you think you identify with that or not. And then if you do want to go down the kind of diagnostic route pathway, then you can kind of take that along to your doctors and say, well, this is why I think she's on the spectrum, because the diagnostic criteria themselves don't always pick girls up.
Rachel, that is such wonderful advice. Yes. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been just a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
If I live to be 100, and never see the seven wonders. That'll be alright. If I don't make it to the big leagues, if I never win a Grammy, I'm gonna be just fine. 'Cause I know exactly who
interesting what she was saying about kids at school, the teachers not noticing and saying, oh, they're fine, they're doing really well, they're quiet, they're happy, and then they get home and have a massive meltdown. Yeah. And the parents go, what's happening to my child?
But interesting, the boys and the girls are different.
Yeah.
So a girl looks at things and reacts differently to boys. Well, that's just blown our whole theory.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting just in terms of the male brain and the female brain. There has been some child development research to look at the difference in impulse control and behaviour with girls and boys. And one of the things I learned about, because I've got two girls and a boy, and it was like, oh, boys are completely different, and I went, yeah, we'll see. And they were. I've raised my kids with all the same toys, all the same stuff, no gender preferences, and yet they still behave very differently. And one of the things I heard about girls on the spectrum particularly is, like Rachel was saying, the mimicry. They're very good at just sitting back and watching what everyone else is doing.
And then doing
and
it.
And then fitting in.
Yeah.
Whereas boys will just go head first into something and damn the consequences. And just, oh, okay, I got into trouble for that. couple where the girls will wait and see if anyone else gets into trouble first and fit in a lot more.
Yeah, it's a...
And I think also that, like she was saying, the socialisation is different for girls and boys. Just generally, boys are expected to be loud and obnoxious, and boys will be boys.
But then it's not even an expectation. They tend to be that way sometimes.
Well, yeah, so it's not a surprise when they are. But if girls are... People are surprised when girls behave differently. They expect girls to be quiet and play with the Barbies. And
but there are really noisy girls as well.
I mean, it's just a sort of general, very much a generalisation.
That's why I worry a bit about, because usually they sort themselves out. They can be tomboys and want to go and play on tractors and things with the boys, and you just let them go because they just do it. But it tends to sort of, in most, not perhaps not most cases, but in a lot of cases, just sort itself out.
In a way, it depends on the kid, really. If the kids around them, let them be who they're going to be, and the parents around them, not just their own parents, but the other adults in their community, let them be who they want to be, then fine. But if they've got people from all sides telling them, you're different, you shouldn't be doing that, that's not right.
Yeah, that's very much about...
If you're raised in a very understanding environment, great. And I think often with girls on the spectrum... Now people are becoming a lot more aware of it with the people like Rachel mentioned, and there's a lady, Temple Grandin, that I mentioned to you, who I just think is amazing. She's one of the first people I read about when I was learning about autism and how she described herself as thinking in pictures, and she was very interested in raising chickens. Mm. All sorts of stuff that when you look back, you go, oh, yeah, okay, we can see now that that's autistic traits, the special interest and the preference for certain clothes, but... Because people didn't expect girls to have autism, it was seen as a boy thing. And I read another thing.
I wonder why that happened.
It really is. I think because like the boys who have the autistic symptoms tend to stick out more.
Yeah,
they just tend to be more obvious,
perhaps more aggressive,
or just weird kids stick out more, and the boys don't tend to.
Hold it in.
Yeah, they don't tend to sort of hold back, whereas the girls might just stop and go, oh, people are going to think I'm strange, and they'll just wait and look at what everyone else is doing and try and fit in and practice being normal, rehearse
it
at home.
Mustn't it be really hard, though, when you know you're different, but you don't know what it is?
Oh, yeah.
And you're at school, there's all these groups of people, and there's the hip kids, and there's the kids you don't talk to, and there's this group and there's that group, and you're trying to find your place, and there isn't one, unless you make believe one and make believe that you're this one.
That's it.
So I'll be that one,
and trying to figure out who you are whilst also trying to fit in. And I think that's where the good parenting and good teaching comes in, that teachers and parents recognize these kids individuals, and a parent will usually know if a kid's had a bad day. Again, like Rachel said about the school thought nothing was wrong because the kid was fine at school.
And brilliant.
I've heard this a few times where the child will hold it together at school and be okay and appear perfectly happy and well-adjusted, and then they'll get home and...
And just lose it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And then the school doesn't believe it. The parent will go and say, my kid is struggling, you need to give us some support, we need some accommodations.
No, they wouldn't, because how many times has a parent said, I've got this report here, and they say they're this, and that. They're not like that at home.
Yeah, and also so, you often get, as a parent of a child who's a bit different, you often get labelled as being a helicopter parent, or being overprotective, or being too permissive, not saying no enough, and you'll say, well, you know, they never do this for me at home. Oh, it's because you never say no, or it's because you don't give them enough boundaries, or you should just smack them, then they'll do what you want. So people tend to just assume that the parenting is failing rather than that there's something happening with this kid that needs help. So I think we need to listen to the parents a bit more as well. If a parent is repeatedly saying to the teacher, look, they may be doing fine at school, but they're not fine at home. Yeah. Something else is going on. I think it pays for us to go, okay, what can we do to help you look into this? How can we support you?
The Good Doctor series that we've just watched, and he's autistic, and he's an amazing surgeon. An amazing surgeon. No bedside manner. It's like, oh, am I going to die? Well, yes, you could do.
Yes.
But we're going, and it's just it's almost funny. But he can work out the way to do you know, anything with bodies, anything at all, and he can say, no, that's not going to work when somebody's about to do something.
That's another thing that comes back to girls on the spectrum being more recognisable now. Boys on the spectrum have a lot of characters in the media, whether good or bad characters.
Yeah.
They have a lot of characters out there who either exaggerate the symptoms of Asperger's or autism. But there's not a lot of women on TV or film who people can point at and go, oh, she's on the spectrum.
We watched a Swedish police show. Mm. It was called The Bridge in Sweden. The Sweden between Sweden and Norway, I think it is, there's a bridge. There was a murder in the middle, so half the body was in Norway and half was in Sweden.
Yeah.
So this Swedish policewoman had Asperger's, and she was so dedicated, and she just couldn't do other stuff. And she played the part wonderfully well, but she was just so different in the social skills.
Well, I think the more we have that in TV and media as being just another interesting character.
Yeah, because she was a brilliant policewoman.
Yeah, that we can go, oh, look, to these girls who are struggling, say, hey, look, there's people out there. You're represented in the media in a positive way.
Do you think it's
really
bad out there for girls with...
I think it's improving. I mean, I'm neurotypical. I don't have... My kids are neurotypical. I don't have personal experience of what it's like for people. But I think the more people are becoming aware of autism and the range that the spectrum is, it's just enormous.
Yeah,
and people are starting to become a lot more aware of it. There's a lot more open discussion about it. The rise of social media has given people who would otherwise be non-verbal a voice, which I think is fantastic. So that it's improving slowly, but there's still a lot of stigma attached just to autism in general, let alone being a woman on the spectrum.
I think because if you say autism, you imagine somebody really...
Yeah, people think Rain Man. They think Dustin Hoffman as Rain Man. And we're getting away from that slowly, but people still do think like that.
When you look at who we've interviewed...
We've interviewed some phenomenal people,
I just love the way they think.
Yes, that out-of-the-box thinking.
Out there.
And that's something that...
It's joyous. Yeah, and that's something almost refreshing, isn't it?
Yes, it needs to be... And that's it.
That way of thinking.
We need to teach our kids, girls and boys, that this way of thinking is really valuable to society and really important. We need to nurture it.
Yeah.
You know, we can all benefit from it.
Gosh, yes. It's amazing. And you think, well, they've had all that to deal with at a young age and gone on to 8 subjects here. Yeah, I've been dancing all my life. So, you know, we'll leave the earth science behind and we'll go and be a dance teacher. And they do.
Yeah.
That's what gets me.
That's all about, I think, is having that support from her family. She's obviously had some good support networks around her to be able to do that. And I think that's what we as parent-to-parent do, is we help those families to support those kids in those difficult situations. And that's what we need to do more, is say, hey, look, the sport's out there. Mm. We're here. You're not alone. There are other people like you. And there's lots of ideas, lots of strategies. And look at all these people we know who've been successful in their lives.
They almost put you to shame. Their success is sort of like... wonderful. Okay.
We'll finish that conversation and move on.
Connect, inform, support. Join us next week on Free FM 89.0 for support and information from parent to parent. The program can be downloaded as a podcast. And of course, you can get more information on our website, parenttoparent.org.nz.
This has been Family, Whānau and Disability from Parent to Parent. I have been your host, Johanna. We hope that you enjoyed the podcast and that you'll join us again soon.